It's the Burt Cohen Show. Part of our history, of course, we take for granted our incredibly valued, precious freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Freedom of speech and the press may have been a lot easier to both define and protect. The days of papyrus and quill pens have long been replaced by electronic digits and the ability to spy and take notice and pry into other people's personal messages. Wow, has really come a long way.
Well, and as I was writing last week, it's less than a century ago that the Secretary of State, the American Secretary of State, put an end to a code breaking facility at the State Department because he said, "Gentlemen, don't open other gentlemen's mail."
Just over 100 years ago, huh? So just wow. Yeah, the early part of the 20th century doesn't look a lot like the early part of the 21st century, for sure. Well, Michael Winship is our guest today, and he is senior writer at Moyers and Company, great show on public television, senior writing fellow at the policy and advocacy group Demos, and president of the Writers Guild of America, the eastern half of the nation. Well, let's look at a little bit of the early history, and we, you know, just so treasure, or at least traditionally have treasured, freedom of the press and freedom of speech. At the time of our founding, where was the ownership of the means of communication? You know, at first it was as simple as taking to the village green and standing up and speaking. But in the early days, who did own the means of communication, such as newspapers and things like that? All privately owned, I assume?
Well, yeah, but of course they were also much more blatantly partisan, although, you know, now that we have Fox News, that's changed back. But, you know, in those days, parties really got their message out through newspapers, and often the message was extremely, extremely partisan and extremely biased against one side or the other. And in fact, the Postal Service, I mean, part of the reason that the Postal Service existed was for the delivery of newspapers throughout the country as it was growing.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, people lambast the media today and the political ads today, but they were pretty vicious.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
And it was, and that tradition, you know, we just have to live with that, I guess. And I don't know how we morphed from believing and understanding, yeah, this is the liberal press, the radical press, whatever, as they have so often in Europe. When did we come to expect sort of an objective press, which, of course, is completely elusive and really unrealistic?
You know, I think that it's an excellent question. I'm thinking that a lot of it happened once we got into the 19th century, and I think a lot of the reporting of the Civil War, for example, and then with the muckrakers in the late part of the 19th century who came out, you know, people like Upton Sinclair,
right,
and Ida Tarbell and people, right, like that who really came out swinging against the grief, you know, against the terrible things that big industry was doing, that big business was doing, when you had a Congress that was controlled by corporate interests so incredibly thoroughly, even more so than today. Hmm. And those reporters were real trailblazers in exposing the truth.
And so it was still profitable. I mean, that's the bottom line that there has always been.
Well, that's true, too. It's a combination of that and also the fact that there's so much consolidation of media now that has weakened the independent spirit in reporting.
Well, let's take a look. I mean, there's a lot to look at. We're talking with Michael Winship, senior writer with Moyers and Company, about freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and the concentration and centralization of the power of the media has been something that, I don't know, I'm not sure if most Americans really are aware of it. I mean, for example, Disney owns ABC.
Right.
Last time I checked, anyway, Comcast owned NBC, although they may have been sold since then. I don't know. But, you know, there's a distinct lack of public involvement in decisions concerning the mass media.
Yeah. It has an enormous impact both on local news coverage, investigative reporting, and then just also in general the diversity of these companies, because there's not a lot of minority ownership anymore. They've been bought out. Not a lot of women owning media companies anymore. It's a real problem.
And what does that look like? What does that translate to? How has it affected the news that we consume?
Well, it translates into a homogenization of what we know about. I mean, it translates into everybody reading the same material and reading the same facts. It translates into the fact that a lot of markets now, a lot of television and radio markets now, these big media companies own several stations in the same town. And in some cases, the television reporting, I'm not sure if it's true where you are, but I've seen it in other towns, upstate New York, for example, you'll have one news organization covering two or three different channels so that you don't know you're getting the exact same news word for word on the same channels.
Huh, that reminds me a little bit of TASS, the official Soviet news agency.
Yeah, except this time it's, you know, it's, as you said, Fox and Comcast and Disney.
Yeah, and that's pretty much it. And to have, you know, one state media is kind of, it seems to me anyway, from my knowledge of American history, really, really out of the American tradition. It's a bit different. And
Certainly
my first real clear knockout impression of this was in the run-up to the war in 2003,
sure.
when Bush made war on Iraq, and how there was just no dissenting voices. It was all just like one official media outlet.
Right, and because you had, I mean, one of the few groups that was really doing tremendous reporting on this was McClatchy Newspapers, which was Knight Ritter then, I believe. But McClatchy was doing great reporting, but because McClatchy didn't at the time have a big outlet in New York or Washington, nobody was getting to see what they were reporting.
Hmm. They were in the Midwest, is that right?
Yeah, well, they have a Washington bureau and stuff, but they don't have, Midwest, and they do have Washington bureau and this kind of thing, but in point of fact, you know, they didn't have an outlet. They didn't have a newspaper in which they were being published in Washington or New York, so not a lot of people saw it. Bill Moyers did a tremendous documentary on this called Selling the War a few years ago that really hit a lot of these points.
And it was, I just remember it being extremely frustrating to see just, you know, one official line coming down. Was there, I mean, aside from whatever competition there was from other news sources, McClatchy and other, was there any kind of outcry, or did the big media, the concentrated centralized media, from that experience learn, we can get away with this?
Yeah, no, I mean, and by the way, I said Selling the War, I meant Buying the War was the name of that documentary, which you can actually see at our website. The upside was that in response to those big voices that were so controlling the message was that it was at that point in time that you started seeing the growth of independent journalism on the Internet.
Hmm.
And although they don't have the facilities necessarily that the big corporations have, they did provide that opposing voice that started asking questions.
So that did kind of help the growth of the independent, really independent voices on the Internet.
I believe so. I mean, I think their reporting of the war, those independent voices reporting of the war, actually helped solidify and gain credibility for those outlets.
Interesting. And I wonder, did the, you know, always chasing the buck, of course, did the, you know, ABC, Disney, Comcast, et cetera, did they recognize this and start to broaden some of their approach and try to at least look a little bit more independent? Or did they?
Well, I think so. You know, you saw, for example, if you remember in 2004, Nightline did that broadcast where they listed the names of every single American who'd been killed in Iraq.
Right.
And that led to an outcry at a company called Sinclair Broadcasting, which, even as we speak, is in the process now of acquiring more and more TV stations. They refused to run that Nightline and, in fact, ran some of the swift boating propaganda against John Kerry instead.
Yeah. My goodness.
And in the last election, you might recall, they also were in a situation where they were providing scripts that were basically pro-Romney scripts that they were having their news anchors read on the air.
And I wonder how given the style of American journalism in the 18th century and the 19th century, how some of those historical figures might react. Would they say, oh, this is fine, this is in concert with what we envisioned?
I think some of them would, actually.
Right.
I think there are certain Whigs and Tories who would look at the Fox News and say, yes, that's basically what we were trying to tell people.
Right. It's really interesting. But I remember back in the late 60s looking at the prospect of cable TV. This is when there were, just three stations plus the educational network, and the idea that there could be more diversity through mm-hmm. cable TV, and it was a very exciting possibility. Do people, Michael, do people still look to the network news and get most of their information and accept what's coming down from the network news as gospel as much? I'm guessing they do.
Pretty much, yeah. I think that's right, Bert. I mean, I think that, one of the few independent sources to this day on television is public media, public broadcasting, and public radio.
And, of course, community radio.
Yeah, exactly. And we have seen in the last few years in the Obama White House this increase in the number of low-power community stations, which can't be anything but a good thing. But certainly, all the surveys that you see still show that television news is still the place where most people give their information.
Yeah, it just has that sort of Cronkite credibility that we've just kind of grown up with.
Yeah.
If you just tuned in, our guest today is Michael Winship, senior writer at Moyers & Company on public television. I got no cameras in here, a whole bunch of mics and wires, but no cameras. And we're talking about freedom of speech and freedom of the press. I mean, all media does exist in the hope of being profitable, which isn't bad.
Yeah.
Has the power of the press and freedom of the press always been guided by simple capitalism? And if so, let's face it, covering the news, it can be fairly capital intensive. It takes quite a bit of money. It may not be the most profitable thing, but sending reporters all over the world, ain't cheap. And sometimes these reporters, I know it'll shock you, have egos and want to be paid well. But,
like you and me, Bert.
Yeah, you're right. Hey, we're worth it. But
we make the big bucks.
Oh, my goodness, yes. But, has that aspect, having the necessary capital, has it changed so dramatically as to alter what we think of as a free press? And, is the big media that has this money, are they investing in better investigative reporting? And if
no, that's the problem. I mean, it's the same problem that you see across the board in terms of corporate America, is that they're taking those vast profits and they're basically keeping them. Uh-huh. They're not investing in. They're certainly not investing in their news departments. You don't see a vast expansion of television news. I mean, I'm old enough to remember. You mentioned Cronkite. I mean, I remember those days when CBS had bureaus all over the world and NBC had bureaus all over the world, and now they just seem to be constantly shrinking them down.
And is that simply the profit motive because it is capital intensive? Isn't there a demand from the public for more of this? More and more,
despite the fact that, the majority of people or the largest number of people are still getting their news from television,
right?
More and more there is the competition from the Internet, and more people are watching news on the Internet.
That's true. I wonder if, for example, Al Jazeera is cutting in to the the Nielsen ratings at all.
I don't know. They haven't. We're due to get the new Al Jazeera network here in New York City, but it hasn't started yet. Their coverage here hasn't started. We were getting the Al Jazeera English channel, which was tremendously useful during the Arab Spring. When they started the new U.S. network, cable here didn't pick it up, but they now are. So I'm not quite sure when that's going to start. But speaking of cable, you were talking about the hope of cable and the potential of cable, and that's what we see now, certainly in terms of the Internet, and that's the big fear among a lot of people involved in internet that it will suffer the same fate that the cable business has suffered, which is this incredible consolidation and total control and trying to cut off the ability of everybody to have equal and open access.
Interesting. So cable has been bought up as well in the same, looking for dollars.
Mm-hmm.
We have an obviously rather white right-wing station, the Faux News, also called Fox News. You know, their agenda is pretty obvious. And
MSNBC from
others. Well, absolutely. Yeah. MSNBC. And it does seem I have had the privilege of watching Al Jazeera. It's come to at least this part of New England where they're and it's pretty serious news. It's like the news we used to have, and I look forward to it being spread more around. But an old friend, Abby Hoffman, in the late 60s, when we talked, he and I talked about the potential for cable news, he says, I mean, we recognize there are right-wing and, slightly left-of-center stations like MSNBC. He wondered, when's there going to be a real left station?
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, there isn't one. Is that just because there isn't a demand for it? I wonder if they'd start it up if there might be a demand for it.
Well,
that.
I think, Amy Goodman does a tremendous job with Democracy Now! And it has a great many outlets in public media and community stations. And Amy's a good friend. I think she does a tremendous job. She just doesn't reach the kind of audience that Fox reaches and that MSNBC reaches, even though, you're not talking humongous numbers when you're talking about MSNBC.
Right.
But certainly they're reaching more folks than Amy is. But Amy is the one great, I think, exemplar of what that kind of broadcasting can be.
Yes, it certainly, and there the potential for diversity is still there, even more so in the digital age, which is what we're talking about now on the Bert Cohen Show with our guest Michael Winship. And
I'd throw in Laura Flanders in there too. I think Laura does a great job, but not enough people get to see her.
And there are some others as well whose names I can't think of right now, but there's a few. And, of course, I'd like to be out there more and reach more people.
Well, you and Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman, that's what I was thinking of,
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, no doubt the Republican Party is quite fine with things like Fox News, and they're fine with consolidation. And I wonder about the Democrats. Are they any different at all, or are they just basically marching in lockstep with, let's have just a few centralized voices here?
Well, this is a good point that you make, because we have seen the Democrats marching in lockstep on this. We certainly saw it during the Clinton administration with the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which only served to speed up this media consolidation that's been, I think, so hurtful to independent voices. What's interesting is that we have a new chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, who was a lobbyist for the cable industry and for the cell phone industry and so forth, and was a major Obama campaign contributor. But he has said some things which indicate that he might be a more independent voice than we thought. He has just this week, or in the last few days, expressed some support for net neutrality, which is this idea of the free and open Internet. So we'll have to see what happens, but this, it always comes down to money, and these telecommunications giants have given money to both parties, including the Democrats. So it tends to keep them docile when it comes to media reform.
And you mentioned the 1996 Act. Could you refresh our collective memory on that one with regard to?
You know, Bert, I'm not an expert to really go further on that. I just don't have it right at my fingertips, but it certainly did allow more media consolidation.
Uh-huh.
And, just to say in passing, not to give us a shameless plug, but in terms of finding that voice, that voice from the other side that you were talking about, it was fascinating when we announced that we were going off the air on January 3rd.
Which
we had always said we were only going to be on the air for 2 years, and we officially announced that January 3rd would be our last broadcast. We were overwhelmed with the response from the public, which was just that, please don't go off the air, please don't leave, please stay on. We need this voice, Bill's voice. And we got so much response that we are, in fact, staying on the air. We're coming back in a half-hour format instead of an hour, just because of the grind and stress of an hour is so cumbersome. But we will be back as a half hour. But it was because of the fact that the public so very much needs this kind of voice that we're coming back, that we're staying on the air.
And that is good to know. Oftentimes people, I mean, I really feel like Americans in general, I mean, feel that we are powerless and accept our powerlessness more than a lot of other Western industrialized nations. And we are not at all powerless. There's a perfect example of it that you just described, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats, you know, Republicans, a lot of differences on a lot of things. One, you know, the media consolidation is really not so different. I mean, oftentimes, you know, they look to the same corporations for their campaign contributions.
Exactly.
And the Obama administration, you know, he promised to be the most transparent administration ever, transparent and accountable. But it's often said that this Obama administration has been harsher to press freedoms than any president since Richard Nixon. Tell us, if you would, please, about Obama's actual record in this regard. Is it true that there have been more prosecutions of journalists than all prior administrations combined?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there have been prosecutions, and we've seen things like the surveillance on Associated Press and the seizure of Associated Press records. And we've seen, you know, the prosecution of whistleblowers that's been going on.
Well, let me just...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Let me just stop you there. Tell, you know, the AP, we Americans tend to have short memories, myself included. The Associated Press thing, what was that all about?
That was just about seizing records of their reporting, basically.
On what subjects?
On what subject? Was about surveillance, about the surveillance being done by the NSA and other aspects of our war reporting. They had their records seized.
So the Obama administration Justice Department did that?
Yes.
What else has Obama done with regard to prosecution of journalists?
Well, you know, certainly in terms of the whistleblowers, the response to Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald, who's at his home in Brazil, not able really to travel very much because there's such a campaign against him because of the Snowden work. There's just a lot of it going on. There's certainly far more than I think, you know, you mentioned Richard Nixon. I think it's totally right that Nixon has, since those days, and I was in Washington on those days, and I remember it very well. It's kind of unbelievable. It's a lot of it is not as visible,
right?
But it's taking place.
Yeah, it does seem the scale of it was actually far less for Nixon. My memory isn't that great on that, but as I recall, you know, Nixon had his personal enemies, and that's who he would go after. But like a wide clampdown on the press, I mean, you had the whole Watergate thing, which was tremendously profitable for the media. It was a wonderful time to be in the news business.
I know. That was the great irony of Watergate, was that very fact, that it did generate such incredible reporting. And we haven't seen that kind of reporting, you know, in the mainstream media as we did then, partly, again, not to keep harping on consolidation, but partly because of that, because you don't have the family-owned newspapers now. You've just seen the Washington Post go over to Amazon, and you've seen, you know, things like that happen, and they just don't, we don't know yet. I mean, it's very early on in terms of
Washington Post.
Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post. We'll see what he does with it. But, you know, just didn't exist. It's interesting with the Snowden case, because it does seem now like the mainstream media, especially the Washington Post and the New York Times, are finally getting into this story and spending time reporting it.
It's been so curious, that whole Snowden phenomenon. And I do want to talk about that, but I don't want to get off, you know, leave the president alone. What do you make of this? It's so hard for many people to believe. I mean, you know, Obama has a lot of supporters. He obviously beat whoever that other guy was. but, you know, they tend to be fairly progressive, at least slightly left of center, and theoretically care about our traditional American values of freedom of the press. Why is he doing this? It seems for many people, when they hear Obama's been tougher on the press and prosecuted reporters more than any other president, or probably than all others combined, it seems that there's kind of a cognitive dissonance on this. What the heck is he doing? Why is he doing this? Any clue?
I think partly, you know, there's certainly the national security question is an issue. I think there is the concern of another 9/11. There are concerns about that. But I also think that it just, you know, probably more importantly, it reflects a sort of overall disrespect for the press, an overall feeling that the press is just out to get them, and so they're going to push back and not allow, you know.
But is there basis in fact for that? Is the press more out to get President Obama than others?
I don't feel like it is. I don't feel like it is any more than it has been in past administrations. I mean, you know, people have their, obviously reporters have their political feelings and so forth, but I don't think there has been a heavy-handed persecution of this president in the mainstream media.
Well, but there has been some prosecution of independent journalists.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. That's the problem. I don't think it's been fair.
People are not aware of it. That's true. People were very much aware of Nixon's doing stuff, you know, breaking into Ellsberg's psychiatrist.
Sure.
I mean, that's, you know, easy to see and pinpoint. But if this is widespread, has there been a chilling effect discernible from this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think you know, as I say, the mainstream media has finally gotten into the Snowden story and is reporting material from the Snowden revelations. But it took a long time for them to do it. You know, they were afraid of it. I think also too, another aspect of it, Bert, is the fact that people were suspect. Mainstream media were suspect of people like Glenn Greenwald, who's a friend and colleague of mine, who they didn't perceive of as being a, you know, quote, serious journalist. And I think that had an effect as well. The fact that Snowden, you know, went to Glenn and Laura Poitras was a reflection of the fact that he felt he would get the fairest shake from them, and that they would not necessarily put all the limits on him that somebody like a New York Times or a Washington Post would. I mean, that has changed in the weeks since these revelations first started coming. But I think there is a certain attitude on the part of the press, which is not altogether unfounded, but sometimes the people who are reporting these stories are not, you know, as I say, quote-unquote serious journalists.
Well, journalists also, let's face it, can be lazy and just take...
Oh, yeah.
That's
look at the White House press corps, my goodness.
Well, I think it was H.O. Mencken who said something like, never ascribe evil intent where mere incompetence is the likely culprit.
I would tend to agree with that. I feel that way about most conspiracy theories. When you have the choice between conspiracy and incompetence, you're usually best to go with incompetence.
Yes, that's true. And we did a couple of shows about, you know, the 50th anniversary just a few weeks ago. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show now with Michael Winship, senior writer at Moyers & Company on public television, of course, senior writing fellow at the policy and advocacy group Demos, and president of the Writers Guild of America, the Eastern part of that. Well, it's a big guild, isn't it?
Well, we have two. Yeah, there's the Guild East and the Guild West, and I'm president of the Guild East. And we are two independently incorporated groups, but we negotiate together. We work together very closely. In fact, I'm heading to Los Angeles on Thursday for some meetings with them.
And the Writers Guild, I would think, must, you know, not exactly like the clampdown that's come from the Obama administration being spied on. And
oh, absolutely not. Yeah, no, we've been very upfront about our opposition to that kind of thing. We've been very open in our support of things like net neutrality. I mean, you know, the interesting thing about a Writers Guild is that you're not only protecting their rights as union members, but you're also protecting their rights as creators of news. Because, you know, here in the East, we've got about 4,000 members in the East, and about 1,500 of those members are in the news business. So we're very, very aware of those issues.
And trying to make some noise from time to time.
Exactly.
Well, the subject of net neutrality has come up a few times here. What is net neutrality, and isn't it something that we've discussed it a while ago. It's confusing. It does seem that liberals are on both sides of the issue. Does the public understand and actually care about the importance of a free and open and uncensored internet?
Well, they should, certainly, because among other things, if it doesn't exist, it's going to cost them more money.
Say more what you mean on that.
Well, I mean, it's going to cost them more money in terms of Internet fees, in terms of accessing their Internet providers and so forth. I mean, part of this, if you're somebody who's providing material to the Internet, who's disseminating their message on the Internet, part of this whole problem is that if you end net neutrality, you have a situation where somebody like Verizon or Comcast or whomever can say, you know, if you pay me twice what you pay the normal guy, I'll give you much faster access. And you'll have much faster people who will be able to get to you faster. You will have first priority. And somebody, you know, like a small Internet operation, like some of the terrific aggregators we have that report the news, the smaller groups like Truthout and Alternet and so forth, well, you guys will have to be backburnered. You'll still get your message out, but it'll be harder for you to get it out unless you pay these increased fees.
I wonder if does the public understand how important this is, and what is the status of right now? I know there's been, you know, a lot of lawyers have made some money from this issue.
Yeah, no, there it's a couple of things. First of all, as I mentioned, we have a new chair of the FCC,
right?
And so people are sort of waiting to see where he comes down on this. But there's also some legal cases pending that are going to have an impact on this in terms of, you know, whether or not the FCC has jurisdiction with the Internet,
right?
Because that has been an issue as well.
Well, that brings up an interesting question in and of itself. And, you know, how about how things have changed so radically in the digital age? It was the FCC, the Federal Communications Issue, Commission, rather, at least in theory, has been the traditional watchdog for press freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come down with this whole net neutrality thing and in the future, the FCC?
Well, you know, it's somewhat going to depend on how this next court case comes out, which is all about whether or not the FCC has the jurisdiction, because it has to do with the definition of what the public airwaves are. Theoretically, it has always been that the public owns the airwaves, and that the Federal Communications Commission regulates them on our behalf. Now, you know, in practice, this has not always been the case, but it's supposed to be the case, and that's what the FCC has maintained in terms of Internet freedom. You know, there's been some back and forthing and some compromising, but we have managed to uphold the principle of net neutrality so far, but whether or not that will continue to be the case is up in the air.
And in your estimation, just, you know, sort of a Cliff's Notes version of it, net neutrality, a good thing?
Yeah, I believe so, absolutely. Because it gives, you know, when I look at it from my Writers Guild viewpoint, it's a very good thing for our writers because it encourages creativity and allows them to get, you know, a lot of what we're working on now in terms of media, in terms of the Writers Guild. You know, when we went on strike in 2007, that famous 100-day strike, the major issue that we had was about the Internet. It was about the use of our writers' material on the Internet, either stuff that had been written for television or the movies or original material created for the Internet. So it's very important to us. And then just from a public viewpoint, if I want to be able to continue to go to these different websites, if I want to continue to be able to go to your website, Bird, or Alternet, or Truthout, or Common Dreams, or any of these terrific alternative news sites,
and they are.
Without paying more money and while being able to have the freedom to see what I want to see out there, you have to be in support of net neutrality.
So, in essence...
Now, the counter-argument has been, and in the entertainment industry, the counter-argument has been that net neutrality encourages piracy. That there's not enough monitoring, that it encourages people to go in and pirate motion pictures and television shows and offer them free of charge or whatever and cheat the creators out of the fees. Our argument is that with increased maintenance of watchdog abilities and so forth, that that fighting piracy and still supporting net neutrality are not mutually exclusive positions.
So then if you don't want to pay more for non-mainstream voices, you should support net neutrality.
Yeah.
It's sometimes it's a difficult concept to define.
It's difficult, and net neutrality is not the most encouraging of phrases in terms of stirring up interest. I mean, it sounds like Swiss tennis, you know. So you really, it's hard to get people excited about it.
And again, on, you know, the left-right divisions, it I wonder now, you know, has the right been more concerned, been more vocal about press freedom and government transparency than the left these days?
That's an interesting question. I
don't hear a lot from the left. I really don't.
I don't, you know, the right has been more about preserving its voice.
Yes.
And
its access.
Yeah, and access, certainly. I mean, I believe the NRA has been in support of net neutrality, for example.
Whoa.
Rare
when I agree with them.
I know. Absolutely. But I can't really say that the left has been less so. I'm not sure that's the case.
And certainly, you know, there has been, since the founding of this country, a lively debate about security versus freedom. As Ben Franklin said, those who surrender freedom for security will not have, nor do they deserve, either one. I've had a lot of friends on the left say, oh, you know, we can't break national security. You know, you have to clamp down on people like Julian Assange and Edward Snowden and many, many people like that who are far less known. That it's really fascinating about how freedom of the press now in the 21st century doesn't necessarily break down on the normal left-right divisions. I mean,
no, it's true. I mean, I understand that, and I have to say that I do think that one of the questions we have to ask is why is it that there are almost a million people, there are 850,000 people in this world who basically have access to the information that Snowden had access to. The fact that there are that many people with sufficient security clearance to be looking at this stuff, I mean, does raise some questions, and I think overall cries out for an overall review of the entire security system. And you know, I live near Ground Zero. I was there that day. I saw those buildings go down, and I recognize the need for national security and recognize the need for counterterrorism efforts. But the issue is how far do you go? And how much of the truth are you telling about the necessity for what you're doing? You know, the NSA claimed that there were, by the way, one of my favorite stories this week was the Fire Dog Lake reported this yesterday, that the NSA had sent out talking points with its employees to use at Thanksgiving dinner.
Oh, my.
They sent out a list of five major talking points with subsets, so that when you were around the family table with everyone at Thanksgiving and they started asking you about your work, that you could address them. But one of the things they keep saying is that the NSA has helped understand and disrupt 54 terrorist events since 9/11. That's the number they always use, is 54. But people have reached the point where they're saying, you know, we've investigated this, we've sorted through it, and so forth. And it's really basically two that we're talking about. And neither of those two were discovering those two was at all dependent on the kind of massive surveillance that's in place now.
Yeah, people, it's been fascinating to me the lack of outcry about the massive surveillance. The NSA spying is just incredibly huge, metadata, mm-hmm. And it's been so odd to me as a card-carrying member of the ACLU and mm-hmm. things like that, what's happened is that journalists who tried to alert us to the fact that that so much of our allegedly private conversations, then the journalists themselves become under attack, and the public doesn't seem to care. What do you make, Michael, of the public reaction to things like Ed Snowden's release of information and the extent of government surveillance? It seems that, you know, the discussion got the revelations, the actual incredible abuse of the system was buried by questions about Edward Snowden personally.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally right. And I think also that people are just afraid. You know, they're afraid of something else happening in this country. And the fact that we haven't had a major attack like 9/11 since 2001 makes people think, well, I guess
right.
they're doing something right.
Mm.
So why should I object to what they're doing if, in fact, you know, nothing has happened and they've been able to prevent things? The issue then becomes, you know, it's like, you know, how much overkill is there in this effort? And how fair is it, for example, that we discovered, you know, last week it was reported, it's been rumored and talked about before, is that what the NSA was doing was not going to Google and saying, let us have access to your files. They were siphoning off the information at the various fiber optic points where they could, you know, that were sort of the weak point in those networks, and just taking it without asking. And, you know, as I said last week, there's a certain irony in that because, of course, Google has been mining all of our personal information, and Facebook and Yahoo and everybody else have been mining our personal information to an unprecedented degree.
Well, I think there may be some sort of a understanding that when we go onto Google that, you know, it's a profit-making business. They're in there to, you know, market us to corporations.
Sure.
But the government is something else entirely.
Yeah. But do you want, I mean, but on a corporate level, do you really want them to have all that information?
Well, not really, no.
No. I don't think so.
But I kind of understand that. And the fact that, you know, that Ed Snowden was personally, you know, attacked.
Yeah.
And he was such the bad guy. That surprised me. I mean, what he did was to reveal, you know, unsettling facts about U.S. foreign policy. And,
well,
and go ahead.
Remember. I mean, again, not to age myself, but you know, I was in Washington during Nixon. I was also in Washington during the Pentagon Papers and Daniel Ellsberg.
Uh-huh.
And you remember how Ellsberg was excoriated in public, and how people were attacking him for having revealed this information about the United States' involvement in Vietnam, none of which, it turned out, was the great security risk that people claimed it
right,
was going
exactly.
to be. All of which simply told the truth about what the military's involvement was in that country. But you remember Nixon, you know, that was part of the White House plumbers, was breaking into Ellsberg's office.
And yet, you had the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Boston Globe
mm-hmm.
publishing what was
yes.
revealed, the actual facts
yes.
about our outrageous policy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that focus seemed to take over, whereas this time it does seem that the powers that be kind of learned from that and kept much more of the focus on this particular personality rather than,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what Snowden revealed was some seriously troubling stuff about
yeah.
U.S. foreign policy.
Well, I think also they took advantage of the fact that Snowden's a young guy.
Right.
He's sort of the classic computer nerd wonk, whatever you want to call him.
Geek, whatever.
He's, you know, he sort of fits a stereotype that many people have, so that it's sort of easy to mock the guy and make fun when, in fact, you know, the information that he has revealed has been enormously important.
Yes.
I mean, we have to have, you'll remember after Watergate, we had the Church Committee.
Yes.
And we had this massive investigation of the intelligence community and what was going on, and it's obviously time for that again.
Yeah, you would think so.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to The Burt Cohen Show. Our guest today is Michael Winship, senior writer of Moyers & Company. We're talking about freedom of the press in particular. You know, journalists, as you said, like members of the Writers Guild, appropriately complain. What about the public? Has the public... What have you seen of the public raising an outcry like, hey, our freedom of the press, something that we have just taken for granted since the founding of this country, you know, it's kind of under attack here.
I think partly they don't know what it is like not to have it,
ah.
you know, compared to so many other societies in the world that to this day face
mm-hmm.
incredible suppression of press freedom. I think also overall, and this is sort of a general overall complaint I have, is when did we stop being citizens and become consumers?
Right. That's
you know?
A big one.
And I think that's a huge problem in this country, is that we're so obsessed with you know, the acquisition of things
mm-hmm.
and the ability to buy and sell things and that that has taken priority over our responsibilities and duties as citizens. And, you know, and when I say that, I don't just mean about the right to vote or
much more than that.
You know, or the responsibility to pay your taxes. I mean the fact that, you know, if this is going to remain a representative democracy, we have to take a voice and play a role.
Yeah, we certainly do. And you spoke fairly recently with Craig Aaron, CEO of a group called Free Press,
mm-hmm.
which was started by John McChesney and John Nichols, great folks,
yeah.
all of them. And
actually, as a result of our show back in the day,
uh-huh.
about 10 years ago on when Bill's program was called Now, he had McChesney and John on, John Nichols,
mm-hmm.
and they talked about this need for a movement in America to start talking about media reform and start taking a greater role in American media. And out of that, Free Press was born.
And it's going ahead, and has it made a difference, you think?
I think it has. I think it has. You know, a lot of what, you know, sometimes it's hard to prove a negative. It's hard to prove the things that they've kept from happening.
True.
But I think they've had an effect in the FCC. They have a very effective lobby group there that does, you know, that campaigns for the issues that Free Press cares about. They've been very vocal. They've been very. I've attended. I guess it's four now of their media reform conferences over the years, and met in Denver this past spring, and I was so impressed with the number of young people who are involved in this movement, and the young people from around the country, from Nebraska and New Mexico and all over the United States, who are getting involved in this, either through things like we talked about, the low-power community stations, or
yes.
or just going out and doing things like, you know, if you remember when this whole issue came up during the 2012 campaign about revealing the money behind campaign ads.
Yes.
And the realization that you can go to your local television station and demand to see the logs, which are now increasingly online, that was all part of a citizen effort. That was all part of Free Press. I mean, I remember when that whole issue came up in 2012, a number of college journalism departments sent their kids into these local stations to get that information. A lot of citizens took it on their own to basically go in and crowdsource this and get that information up on the air. And that made an enormous amount of difference.
And maybe that's one, you know, positive note about, you know, there's all the concentration of voices, you know, reducing the message gets out there by the corporate news media. But a lot of young people exist, and a lot of young people are glued to their little devices, and the internet is, let's face it, as part of their existence is breathing or having their blood flow. And as part of that is, I would think, a demand for freedom and a curiosity.
Yeah. Now, one issue with all that is something that you alluded to before, which is the enormous expense of funding the kind of investigative journalism that we've had in the past in the mainstream media, because, you know, it's very expensive and time-consuming and requires a lot of person power and feet on the ground. And part of it can be accomplished with crowdsourcing and so forth, but you know, it's gonna take some funding of nonprofits, people like ProPublica and groups like that are doing this kind of investigative journalism, but which are nonprofits that need funding.
And one of the things that Craig Aaron of Free Press said, I want to see if you think this is an accurate quote or maybe he's exaggerating. He said that unchecked spying and surveillance strike at the heart of our country, our moral fiber as a country. Is he exaggerating, do you think?
No. No, I don't think so, because it gets down to this fundamental issue of who we are as Americans, as who we are as members of what is purportedly a democratic society.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an exaggeration.
And, you know, the whole word republic of the people, you know, a plutocracy, government of, by, and for, the special, super rich to the exclusion of everybody else.
Right.
It's not traditionally what America has been.
That's right. I mean, we went through that Gilded Age.
Yes.
In the 1880s, from the 1870s to the turn of the century, where you did have an oligarchy, where you did have a plutocracy, where people were, controlling the railroads and oil and other companies were basically controlling Congress, and we're very much in the same sort of period now. It hasn't gotten as extreme,
mm-hmm.
but without something like an independent free press, it'll happen that much faster.
So I always try to encourage people to take appropriate action. You've mentioned a few different organizations that people can perhaps get in touch with and help increase their strength.
Sure. And you mentioned the ACLU, which has been very involved in the surveillance issue. I think it helps to contact your congressman.
Yes.
Your congresswoman or whomever. I mean, Pat Leahy from Vermont and Jim Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, Leahy, Democrat, Sensenbrenner, Republican, have this USA Freedom Act that aims to have this great review of intelligence that we mentioned before, like the Church Committee, and that is trying to put safeguards against over spying on American citizens.
Oh,
there's things that people can do.
That it's called the USA Freedom Act. It's a,
uh-huh.
it's a nice balance to the so-called Patriot Act.
That's right. Uh-huh.
Which
all of this
has not been particularly effective at stopping terrorists, but very effective at clamping down on people's freedoms,
indeed.
I think. Well, if people are interested in following your stuff, any internet places you would suggest that they go?
Well, we have a terrific website. I don't know if people are aware of the fact that in addition to the television show and the radio broadcast, we also have a website, BillMoyers.com, which has all our programs and the transcripts of all our programs and interviews and so forth, tremendous archive of Bill's work over the years. But also we have original reporting. We function as aggregator for various news articles that we think people will be interested in reading, and we're up around, 370,000 Facebook followers.
Whoa!
You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us at the website. Follow us on Twitter. We're very involved in social media, and we will link you not only to a lot of these news sites, but we also will link you to a lot of these citizen groups that are doing important work. We have a huge section of our website that's dedicated to what you can do on various issues, how you can to get involved in things. We have a whole activism spotlight.
Citizenship.
I'm sorry?
Citizenship. Imagine that.
Exactly. All these things.
That's
it's out there. We're out there, and there are others like us, and we're all I would say worth giving a look at.
Well, definitely, and there is actually quite a bit of hope, and any challenge is always opportunity.
Well, and there is, Bill and I were talking about this last week, there is a whole aspect of community and society that grows by having these kinds of connections, by taking these kinds of actions. There's a real, almost therapeutic aspect to it that brings us together and creates a spirit of collegiality.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm loving it. What a great note to end the show on. We're going to keep... Well, thank you so much for being with us, Michael Winship.
Thank you, sir.
Moyers & Company, and we're going to keep rocking in the free world. Thank you so
exactly.
much.
Exactly.
People shuffling their feet, people sleeping in their shoes. But there's a warning sign on the road ahead. There's a lot of people saying we'd be better off dead. Don't feel like Satan, but I am to them. So I try to forget it any way I can. Keep on rocking in the free world. 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 can. Now she put the kid away and she's gonna get a hit. She hates her life and what she's done to it. That's one more kid that'll never go to school, never get to fall in love, never get to be cool. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on.